I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Today is February 26, 2024. We are in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Baker, and myself, Chair Tom McKay. We have enough members to have a quorum and do business. I'd like to thank the staff, Kale, Zach, and Ed, for helping us run the meeting today, and remind everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. We have two items on the agenda today. The first is House Bill 223 related to Cook Inlet royalty rates. And then secondly, we will have a presentation by the AGDC, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. So for the very first thing, we will open our analysis of House Bill 223. I bring the bill back before the committee, and we left public testimony open on HB 223 from our last meeting. So I don't have to hit the gavel. We're still open on it, and we will now ask if there's anyone in the room that would like to testify on HB 223. Seeing none, is there anyone online that would like to testify? All right. So with that in mind, we will now close public testimony on HB 223, and we will set the bill aside waiting for amendments. And brief at ease. Here, we will set HB 223 aside. And now we will have a presentation from the AGDC Executive Frank Richards. So, Mr. Richards, please come forward to the table and introduce yourself and your associate, and please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and with me is
Nick Shimoniak, Venture Developer Manager for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
Chair McKay, Vice Chairs McCabe and Rauscher, and members of the committee, we really appreciate you allowing us to be able to come and provide an update on our work on the Alaska LNG project in order to bring it to a reality. But first, let me introduce another member of our staff that's with us in the office in the hearing room is Mary Soroki, who is our Government and Budget Affairs, and our local Juneau representative. So we appreciate having Mary here. So for members of the committee, as well as members of the public, we also include a list of acronyms at the end of this presentation. So if I use or fall into jargon, I apologize, but hopefully this will provide you some useful information to be able to understand if I use those acronyms. So before I begin into what we've been doing, how we were progressing, I'd like to really just provide a general oversight of who AGDC is. We are a public corporation of the state of Alaska that was created by the Alaska legislature in 2013 in what was House Bill 4. This was an outcome of the work that was done by the legislature under House Bill 369 in 2010. That looked at the need for forming a corporation to bring Alaska's North Slope natural gas resources for use by Alaska citizens. And they gave us, the legislature provided us with specific mission and purposes, and that is to develop natural gas pipelines and transportation mechanisms to be able to provide gas to Alaskans, but also to work on and develop a liquefied natural gas or LNG project. And with that purpose, it also identified that we should be looking to maximize the benefits of those resources for Alaskans and to develop those resources in conjunction with the administration, namely Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue, for the overall benefit of Alaskans. So our primary charge is the advancement now of the Alaska LNG project. And just to provide a general oversight for members of the public that may be listening, this is the $44 billion Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project. It is founded on 40 trillion cubic feet of natural gas on the North Slope of Alaska in Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. So those two fields alone have 40 trillion cubic feet, which is enough to provide for full development of the Alaska LNG project for 30 years. But to put it in perspective, if that 40 trillion cubic feet was used just for in-state needs, that would represent almost 400 to 500 years of resources for Alaskans should we use those resources solely in-state. So they're proven reserves. They're produced on a daily basis in Prudhoe Bay, reinjected back down into the reservoir. Right now they're stranded because there's no mechanism, no transportation infrastructure to bring them to market, either off the slope or through a pipeline. The project will take the gas from those two units, Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, and they'll be combined in what we're calling the Arctic Carbon Capture Plant. This is a gas treatment facility that uses an amine process to capture the carbon dioxide, and then we will compress that carbon dioxide and push it back down into the geologic reservoir for carbon sequestration. There, the gas will flow into the 800-mile, 42-inch diameter natural gas pipeline that will lead from Prudhoe Bay south to Nikiski. It will follow the existing TAPS routes, the Dalton Highway, the Parks Highway, and then ultimately cross Cook Inlet to a terminus in Nikiski, where we'll be building a new 20 million ton per year liquefied natural gas facility, essentially a direct neighbor to the legacy Kenai LNG plant that was first constructed by Phillips in 1967 and operated for nearly 50 years.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Richards. So what I'd like to do in format today is have you get through each slide, and then we'll pause for questions at the end of each slide. I think that would be the most organized way to go about this. We have till 3 o'clock, so we have lots of time, and I want to give the committee plenty of opportunity to ask questions. This is a really important subject. We usually get to see you once a year, so we want to make sure we get everything we can get, all we can get, Mr. Richards. So I think first here we have Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McKay. I have a number of questions. Port McKenzie's in my district, so let's start off with that. Why? I'm looking at a FERC report that you essentially had a lot to do with that the Matsu Borough virtually came within a whisker of taking AGDC to court because the report was so flawed. It's now entered into the federal record under FERC, and there is so much wrong with that report, I can't even, it infuriates me, frankly, Mr. Richards. But I'm curious if there is any consideration, now that you know how flawed the report is, to consider Port McKenzie as a terminus instead of Nikiski. It'll be cheaper. Nikiski is running out of land for what they're doing. And I think I understand politically why the report was written that way, but it's troubling that we would consider Point McKenzie versus Port McKenzie and delineate the boundaries for the FERC report that were totally simply wrong. So maybe you can reassure me that Nikiski is not being considered. Maybe there's other considerations other than Nikiski, or are we set on Nikiski for your terminus?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, I believe you're referring to the FERC application. And so in this, FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that is the lead federal agency for the siting and authorization of LNG facilities in the United States. And FERC then, in that role, takes on that position is to be the lead agency that undertakes the environmental impact statement and ultimately, if approved, authorizes the LNG construction. The state of Alaska in 2014 joined up with ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP, and TransCanada at the time, to advance what was then deemed the Alaska LNG project. And during work leading up to that, there was concept selection work that was done primarily by ExxonMobil, but again with its partners, to look at the siting of where the LNG plant should go. So I believe the report shows approximately 85 plus different sites in South Central Alaska, including Prince William Sound, the Kenai Peninsula, the Cook Inlet area, and as far south as, you know, near the and across from Homer. So a tremendous number of sites, including Point McKenzie, was considered.
Maybe I can stop you right there, if you don't mind, through the chair. I'm looking at Attachment B, Table 10.3.2-3, and it says sites excluded from further analysis. The very first one said there is in, it says Point McKenzie, not Port McKenzie. There is incompatible land use, land ownership, because the site is located on a native village, Knik lands. That statement in and of itself is, when you're considering Port McKenzie, is completely untrue. Would you say that I'm wrong in that? There's a difference between Point McKenzie and Port McKenzie. So somehow they have been conflated. Port McKenzie is 14.5 square miles of borough-owned land. It could easily be a pipeline terminus, and yet it was excluded for this report that, from what I understand from the meeting notes from four different meetings that were had between AGDC and the borough, you were involved in. So I'm also concerned about the rest. There's five or six bullet points here that are highlighted for me in this attachment that are completely false. And it's entered in the federal record. So anything that we get to do in Port McKenzie is affected by this document when people go to look at it. So you can imagine my frustration to see a state agency, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, that completely excludes a port that's in my district that could be a major player if not for this document. So I guess my question to you is, how does AGDC, you plan to mitigate the damage that this document has done to Port McKenzie?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, if I don't have the document that you're referring to in front of me, but there was a time when we were in discussions with the Mat-Su Borough, specifically about the issue of Point versus Port McKenzie, and specifically looking at work that had been done, as I indicated, in the original concept selection. My point I was trying to make was the site selection criteria was done before AGDC even became involved in this effort. So we were given the work effort from ExxonMobil, Conoco, BP, TransCanada, and that is what we went forward with to FERC, with the site of Nikiski as the selected LNG location. And so that is what we went through the regulatory environmental process with Nikiski being the site. So that is what is permitted, and that is what the project is designed and based on. Our interactions most recently with the Mat-Su Borough about the issues around the port was to try and work with the borough to talk about this issue that they are hearing back from potential developers on the port as to how it was misunderstood. I'll say it that way, in that no way, shape, or form should the port itself not be deemed as a viable entry port or used for delivery or export of goods. And so, quite frankly, from our perspective, we would appreciate that the Port McKenzie become a viable option for delivery of goods that would support the development of this project.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think, if you don't mind.
I think we better move on or we're going to get stuck on the first slide for the first half hour.
Okay.
Maybe I could ask a question. The existing LNG facility in Nikiski, it's a how many tons per annum was that facility rated for?
Through the Richards. Mr. Chairman, I believe that the Kenai LNG facility, currently owned by Marathon, was last producing approximately 1.1 million tons per year.
So I guess I could obviously conclude that it's way too small for the scope of what you're wanting to do. I like to fix up old things and use them again. But it doesn't sound like we could do that for this scope of project.
Mr. Chairman, again, the when this project is put into operation and there's an opportunity for gas offtake, potentially that location, that facility could be reused again. Depends on their what they're looking at in terms of their economics and what the price of gas would be. But we think that we could provide a favorable alternative.
Okay, I just know that the LNG facility at the end of the pipeline is a very expensive piece of kit to build new, so perhaps that could be looked at. Okay, any other questions on the first slide? Got to get through this. Maybe
I got some on the carbon capture, if you don't mind.
All right, go ahead, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McKay. And through the chair, Mr. Richards, do you need HB 50 to pass before you can before the carbon capture can happen? And if so, do you have a reservoir to store the carbon, or is it or plan to gain a reservoir up there or build a reservoir?
Vice Chair McCabe, I'm going to ask Nick to provide the response.
For the record, Nick Shimoniak, through the chair to Rep. McCabe's question. The construction of the Alaska Carbon Capture or Arctic Carbon Capture Plant is not dependent on HB 50. Our understanding is it would greatly benefit from the passing of HB 50 because it would define better the regulatory process around permitting the wells to sequester the CO2 as well as the pore space that governs the storage. We have not determined which exactly geologic formation would be used for the sequestration. It's possible that some of the CO2 could be used for enhanced oil recovery. It would still be eligible for 45Q tax credits, just at a lower rate. It is important to note that the Department of Energy, in their development of our SEIS, identified one potential zone very proximate to where the gas plant would be that has the capacity to store at least 30, 40 years of the carbon produced by the plant. So there are multiple, my understanding is, multiple zones within Prudhoe Bay area that could be examined.
So if I can help clarify for the benefit of the public, we were able to assign primacy for the Class 6 CO2 disposal wells to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in the last session. So we can handle that in state. So that at least would give you the wells. The wells conceivably would be approved to take care of the CO2. Okay. Anything else?
All right. I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to slide number 4, again, in the economics of the project, the cost stack that you see on the right-hand side, we describe as our cost of supply. And this is really a built-up of all the costs that we factor into in the development of the project. So starting at the bottom with the cost of gas and the fuel gas that will be consumed in the compressors, we peg that at $1.45 per million BTUs. The Arctic Carbon Capture Plant, its operations and capital recovery and debt financing at about 80 cents, with a pipeline at $1.35. The liquefaction of $2.25, and then shipping from Nikiski to the Asian markets at about 70 cents. So that's $6.55 when we look and compare it to existing LNG costs or contracts that are in place right now around the world, we see that many of them are oil indexed, in this case Brent. And so Brent priced at $70, which is the forward projections, they're usually on a slope of that cost at either between 12 to 14%. We chose 13 for this illustration, but that pegs it at $9.10. U.S. Gulf Coast, again, looking at Henry Hub, priced it plus a liquefaction and transportation cost, that is again also around $9. And then the JKM or Japanese Korea market is currently in that $9 range. So those were the metrics that we had to see that we truly had an economic project. This was work that we did in-house, but I also had it verified by Wood Mackenzie. And we have updated this now to consider the construction cost inflation, the supply chain issues, but also indicate that there's 45Q tax credits that will help them reduce the cost of the Arctic Carbon Capture Plant, and then factored in the financial return that investors are likely will want for the capital that they're going to deploy.
Okay, I have a question for you, Mr. Richards. In the third bullet, the 45Q tax credits, it seems like almost every project that we see nowadays is dependent on the 45Q tax credits. If it's probably impossible to say, but if we have a new administration, a new Congress, they could repeal those tax credits. And it is a pass-through tax on the American people. Is that how solid are those tax credits? Do you think that that's virtually impossible, or is that a possibility that those tax credits could go away?
Mr. Chairman, if you recall, what Congress did when they developed the original tax credits for carbon is it was a bipartisan effort. And then that legislation sunsetted, I believe, in 2022. So then it then took another bipartisan effort in 2023 to reestablish the 45Q tax credits that it was available. So it took both Republicans and Democrats to agree that the legislation was warranted and put in place the opportunity now that other developers like us want to take advantage of in terms of utilizing those tax credits to improve the economics of our projects.
Yeah. I just wondered how solid they were. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Through the chair, Mr. Richards, what are the debt service payments and dividend assumptions that you have within this $6.55 delivered cost of supply?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, I'll ask Nick, our economist, to provide the answer.
Great. So through the chair to Rep. McCabe's question, for the entire capital project, the ACC pipeline and LNG facility, we are assuming a 70% debt finance and 30% equity. On the debt financing, we're assuming an 18-year term supported by 20-year offtake agreements, which is pretty industry standard, as well as a 5% interest rate. In recent months, we've seen interest rates go a bit higher. The expectation is that they will probably go back down and have 5% be reasonable by the time we get into construction. This also includes that 30% equity financing at a 10% rate of return on the equity. So the $6.55 also includes the full debt service as well as profit to the investors.
Cool. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay. So there's another cost that should be included, I think, in this, and that's the sale price of the gas at the flange at Prudhoe. I think I asked this last session, but I'll ask it again for the benefit of the committee and the public. Let's use Prudhoe as the example. I guess it's probably the most complicated. You have three owners. You have Hillcorp, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips all own a significant portion of that field, and there may be some other minor owners in there with respect. So when you buy the gas from the Prudhoe Bay unit, you're buying it at one price, and it's like all three owners have to agree on that one price. And then they would get their share of however their ownership is split between the three. Is that so? You have to have all three owners on board to agree on one price, or is it possible you could have three different prices? Am I not understanding how this works, or maybe you could explain that a little bit, Mr. Richards?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Due to antitrust considerations, we can't go to the producers collectively and say, give us a price. So those are bilateral negotiations with each individual producer in those units. So from Prudhoe Bay with, as you said, Exxon, Conoco, and Hillcorp as owners, we will have gas sales agreements with each of those. And then with Point Thompson, again, with ExxonMobil and Hillcorp as the owners, we'll have gas sale agreements from that unit as well.
Right. So who facilitates those conversations? If you can't do it, who can? I'm not quite sure I understand. Who would motivate those companies to come together and give us a price so that we can get going on this project? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, that's been part of our challenge and our frustration over the last year or so, because it's a conundrum that we find ourselves in. We've got the producers that have the gas that want to be able to sell the gas, but they want to make sure they're only entering into contracts with creditworthy off-takers, buyers of that gas. And then the investors that we have been working with and looking to bring into the project, they want surety supply, so they would like to know at the outset what the cost of the gas is.
Right.
So until someone comes up, identifies themselves as a credible, financially with the financial wherewithal to execute the project, then the producers are not willing to enter into these gas sale pricing agreements with AGDC. They're looking for that credible financial partner or entity to be able to contract with. So we're in this middleman game trying to put the two parties together.
I believe they call that an open season. Is that correct? Where you nominate gas? Or am I arguing in too deep?
Do you want to take that?
Yeah, I can do that. To the chair's question, we've discussed with the producer something similar to that, where they make an open offer to the market without a single identified person. And so far, it has not been, you know, they have not decided to do that. We have received some gas prices from some producers, but we have not received gas price offers from all the producers for all the fields. It's varying levels of participation through this AGDC process.
And I assume those prices are confidential?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, I will note, previously we did have gas sales agreements between AGDC and ExxonMobil and BP. And those, unfortunately, sunset and expired. So what we're showing here is our, in terms of that raw gas price, are essentially within, you know, discussion points of where we were in terms of our agreements.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on then. Thank you very much.
Okay, again, I talked about the permitting process that we went through with FERC. This list represents the 36 major federal and two state permits that we have that are now deployed, been given to AGDC. We hold at the ready and are keeping them compliant to be able to move this project forward. This includes the most recent Department of Energy Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, or SEIS, and a revalidation of the export authority to non-free trade countries that the Biden administration, you may recall, last month has now curtailed Department of Energy from authorizing any additional export authorities at this time until a sufficient analysis is done sometime in the future. So we feel very fortunate. We have the DOE authorization. It's not impacted by the executive order from the president. And that puts us in the enviable position of being a fully permitted project ready to proceed. We also have the rights of way that were granted to us by the state and federal governments in hand and ready to move forward.
Okay, so Mr. Richards, there are rumors about competing projects out there on the street. Do any of those competing projects have anywhere near this level of permitting approval?
Through the chair, if you're talking about Mexico, Canada, Gulf Coast projects, some of them have been permitted, but they're on hold while they're waiting for these Department of Energy authorizations to go forward. Some of them are waiting for the FERC authorization, and they're being held up in Washington, D.C. So we feel very, very good that we have all these permits.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thank you. And I'm wondering, Mr. Richards, when the Nikiski, you said it's permitted, or this whole thing is permitted to go through Nikiski. You know, I'm, maybe this is better taken offline, I don't know, but I'm looking at a bunch of data from 2018, four meetings that you had with the borough, several letters that were written directly to you in 2018, long before the dates of most of these permits I see were done, explaining to you the problems with your determination or AGDC's determination or conflation of Point McKenzie versus Port McKenzie. And in some of the letters, I think the borough even overlays Nikiski, the plant, on some area that the borough that could have been used had Port McKenzie been included in the sort of process. So I'm wondering when the Nikiski portion of that was permitted. It looks to me like 2020, maybe.
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, the authorizations were granted to AGDC in 2020. The permit, the application occurred in 2017 with the work that was concluded in 2016 and handed to AGDC.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue, Mr. Richards.
All right, just a general overview. One of the main issues coming out of the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement was to look at greenhouse gas emissions from the Alaska LNG project, asking for a life cycle analysis. This is really part of the outcome. It shows that the use of Alaska LNG in Asia for power consumption, comparing it to coal-fired power consumption in Asia, it is a significant reduction in CO2 emissions. In this case, 77 million tons of CO2 not being emitted a year by using Alaska LNG. Over the 30-year life, that equates to billions of tons of CO2 not emitted. So this is really just a good news story to say Alaska LNG could have a significant positive impact on greenhouse gas reductions.
Okay. Please continue, Mr. Richards.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we feel it almost feels like deja vu because we were here in 2013 at that time when Cook Inlet was under, again, another period of significant uncertainty on where the gas supply was coming from, and that was really where AGDC was created. We have been hearing, you've been hearing from the Cook Inlet producers and utilities that gas availability and price is uncertain going into the future. So they're doing their work to be able to look for ways to be able to meet their needs. And from our perspective, energy security at Alaska is one of the key aspects that we can ultimately help those utilities in this analysis. And that was one of the driving forces, again, as I said, that helped create AGDC with Cook Inlet gas production in decline. So we, over the last several months, have been working with the utilities since January, July timeframe, where they came out with their options in their phase one report. And we saw that they were looking at an in-state pipeline, they were looking at imported LNG, they were looking at various options from renewables, et cetera. And we started working with them to say, we've been here before, we have a permitted project, maybe there are aspects of the project that could be used in terms of meeting the long-term needs in the short-term timeframe that you're falling under. And so, if you recall, in 2020, AGDC also presented to the Biden administration under the Infrastructure Act a proposal on a phased approach using the Alaska LNG pipeline. And that was to bring North Slope gas down into interior Alaska and ultimately South Central Alaska. So that phased approach, we again started talking to the utilities about as what we believe is the best alternative. And in this is phase, when I talk about phase one, I'm talking really about the first initial phase of the entire Alaska LNG project. And this phase one is really about meeting the needs of Alaska to provide for lower cost gas. And we feel that the way to do this is to develop a pipeline to be able to deliver these known resources to Alaskans. And to be clear, again, because of our permits are for the full project, that we're talking truly about the initial phase, which will reduce the project risks considerably for developers to come in and work on the full project. And the only way this will work is if we are able to work with the utilities, work with the gas suppliers to put together essentially the contracts necessary to underpin the financing of this project. We can use our existing permits to be able to accomplish that in a phased approach, and this will greatly then, I think, even help the attractiveness of the full LNG project because we'll address one of the primary risks, construction risk on that project, which has been deemed the pipeline. And then the second phase will be to continue forward with the full LNG export.
Okay, I have a couple of questions for you, Mr. Richards, on that slide 9. I'll start with stating that I believe that NSTAR claims that the current price that they sell gas to consumers in South Central is $8.60 an MCF. That's the number I've seen printed, $8.60. It seems like most experts, and it seems like maybe everybody's an expert on this topic nowadays, but say that imported LNG would be double, maybe even triple that. I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you believe that to be true? Do you have evidence of that. And then I have other people that say, oh, no, the imported LNG, it won't be any more expensive at all. So I guess I'm asking you, who should I believe?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not prescient on where the LNG costs will be. I will say that we're using the public testimony and numbers that have been were provided by the utilities to the legislature and the public, that they were targeting that the LNG import would essentially come in at $12 to $15 per million BTU. So I will call it the target that we were looking at. In order for a phased approach to work, then we had to either be lower than that cost to be able to make this work for Alaskans, to be able to have potentially lower cost energy than importing LNG. Now, as we talked about earlier, the LNG market is, again, very volatile, certainly over the last couple of years, where it went from, let's say $5 and $6 per million BTU up to nearly $75 per million BTU based on, whether it be the supply chain issues, whether it be COVID, whether it be even the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia. So those have sent price shocks into those countries that have had to rely on LNG. And so the consumers and the industry in those countries, some have gone bankrupt because they couldn't absorb those high costs. And ultimately the consumer or the governments had to pay for those. So our concept is meet or beat the price of imported LNG to be an economic project.
So it seems to me, Mr. Richards, if I was proposing this project, it would be a significant gamble for me to say to Alaskans, don't worry about it. Imported LNG won't cost any more than what you're paying right now. That would be a significant amount of risk to state that as a fact and then gamble that would actually happen. I don't think I'm willing to do that. Would you agree with that? Or you see where I'm coming from?
I do, Mr. Chairman. And being in that position of making that decision, trying to be as knowledgeable as you can about where the LNG market may be and where it's going to go, that would be an extremely challenging position to take.
So let me just say that I think it's outstanding that we're talking about maybe breaking this project into phases to reduce the risk. I think that, people have been working on this project for a very long time. And I think that we need to be, I applaud you guys. We need to be more creative. We need to be more realistic and maybe break some paradigms to try to make this happen. When you say in the third bullet, when you say you can move into construction quickly, it's a pretty good adverb, quickly. What do you mean by quickly, Mr. Richards? Can you define that a little more for us?
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I will advance to slide 14.
Uh-oh. Now you're going to mess me up. Okay.
I don't mean to mess you up, Mr. Chairman, but this is a timeline that, again, previous slides I'm going to talk about the need to conduct a front-end engineering and design level of effort. We envision that to take approximately 12 months. So our goal to be able to meet the needs within Alaska at the earliest possible date is that we would have our FEED funding achieved by July 1 of this year, and then we will then execute a FEED contract with engineering, procurement, and construction contractors to be conducted. At the same time, we'll be working on those commercial and agreements between the buyers of the gas and the sellers of the gas, as well as the overall project development agreement with a pipeline company to deliver the project. With a final investment decision in July of 2025, we're looking at a four-year construction window. Again, you need long lead items, namely the pipe in this case, to be ordered and then to be delivered to Alaska through our ports and our railroad and on the Dalton Highway. And then into construction with three winter seasons, two summer seasons, to be able to then have gas delivered into the NSTAR system in South Central Alaska by July of 2029.
So if we're going to drop off the LNG facility at Nikiski or wherever the terminus is, if we're going to push that into a different phase, then the feed and the that we're talking about in this slide could just be the Arctic carbon capture facility and the pipeline.
Mr. Chairman,
so what we could maybe make that a simpler process and a faster process. You see what I'm saying?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Right now, what we're looking at is a gas supply from the North Slope, field agnostic, that could be used and delivered into a pipeline to deliver gas, pipeline quality gas. So when I say that term, it's gas that meets the NSTAR operating specification, which is up to maximum 3% CO2. The LNG project will require gas that has no more than 50 parts per million, so significantly less CO2 equivalency. So in this concept of phase one, we're not talking about the treatment plant. We're only talking about the pipeline portion. So the feed will only be on the pipeline itself,
okay,
not on the upstream.
And, of course, we could take out that extra CO2, that 2 or 3%. We could take that out at Nikiski or wherever the terminus is, right? We wouldn't have to take it all out on the slope, or would we?
The concept right now for full project is, again, taking it all out on the North Slope within the Arctic caption.
I'm trying to kind of make it a little easier to do the project, right? You see what I'm saying?
I greatly appreciate that. I just want to make sure that what we have with our permits is a well-defined project. And so if you make any alterations, significant alterations by plant location design concept, then you will likely have to reopen the environmental permits, which I'm not looking to do because that creates additional time and risk.
No, we wouldn't want to mess with the permits. Okay, maybe I better give some others a chance. Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So I received an email from a constituent who said, what are you guys doing? You appear to have been, what do they call it in business world, paralysis by analysis for the last two decades, and wanted to know pretty much what Chairman McKay said is, what is quickly, you know, how soon can we get done, how soon can we start it? But one of the things that he brought up that was interesting to me is, have you completed all the rights-of-way purchases? I looked on his timeline. I didn't see anywhere in the timeline where it said rights-of-way, what kind of right-of-way purchases we need to do if all those are complete. So,
through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, again, the paralysis by analysis is, as an engineer, I hate to have to continue to do design efforts when you feel like you've reached a good design. In this case, AGDC has already done a feed level of design on the pipeline, which was the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. We completed that in 2015. It was along the exact same right-of-way that the Alaska LNG project will follow, and that was one of the benefits of AGDC joining with the producer partners, was we brought that with us. We find ourselves now, again, 10 years hence, and really what this feed analysis will do will be to update the design specifications to a certain extent, but also some of the metallurgy validation that is necessary on this pipeline as opposed to the 36-inch pipeline that I talked to previously. And then with it, it'll be an update of not only the cost and schedule, but also the construction contracts and specifications that you would then put out to the EPCs, engineering, procurement, and construction contractors that will be constructing the project. So that's why, again, it's necessary with the pipeline company that we're working with that they will put it on their paper because they're the ones that are going to be contracting for it. So it takes time for them to validate and update the work that we've done to date. Now, the second point of your question, I apologize. Remind me.
Right away. Chair, I actually think you answered it when you said it was following the rights away that were previously purchased. It's a big concern with many of our projects. We start into a phase one of the project, and then phase two gets held up because, oh, we forgot to pay farmer so-and-so or however. So they're concerned that we're going to be in another hang-up if we have to purchase rights away or renew leases from whoever, whether it be Native corporations or that sort of thing. So,
So to that point, very good point. We've been making sure that we've kept all of our right-of-way leases up to date and in negotiations with private landowners on right-of-way across their lands. And they're making great progress. And so I would say we're in a very good position. As I showed on the previous slide, for the entire 800-mile pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Nikiskie, we had over 93% of the right-of-way already granted to us. So we've got municipal lands, we've got borough lands, we've got some private lands and native corporation lands.
So if I could follow up then, are you paying fees for those leases, cash out the door, Mr. Richards?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to the federal government for the lands that were granted to us by the Bureau of Land Management and the National Park Service. The state of Alaska, with their conditional lease that they've granted us, are not requiring us to pay a lease payment.
So, heaven forbid, if you didn't have the funding, you'd have to let those leases go into default. And that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing to get the project underway quickly. I think I want to point out that you do need some money to keep all that part of the project in place.
Mr. Chairman, you stated accurately. We need to be able to keep those permits in compliance, but also pay for the right-of-way fees. Otherwise, the federal agencies can take those leases back.
Okay. Representative Mears had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. So looking at the timeline, we've got 6 months for the capital raise. I see on the previous slide. Thanks for supplying those. That it's $50 million for that work. How much do you have on hand, and who's paying for the rest of it?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, with your indulgence, maybe I can go back to the slide and talk through our the status of the project and what we need to move forward.
Yeah, let's take it in order. Is that okay with you, Representative Mears? Let's stay on track with the slides.
That good?
I don't want to get too, going back and forth too much, but we won't forget. Promise. So we were on 9.
We were on 9. I was moving to 10.
Okay.
10 is, again, just reiterating that it's a 42-inch pipeline that is designed and permitted under the Alaska LNG project. We are currently working, again, with a very credible North American pipeline company to take on the lead for this, to be able to take on construction operations and ownership of this project. And then the contracts with the producers, we'll be looking to contract with either one or more of the producers at a reasonable rate to be able to support the economics of this project and provide hopefully low-cost energy to Alaskans. And there are multiple sources in and around the North Slope that could supply the gas. The project to move forward will require contracts with end users, and in this case, we're looking at two distinct groups. One is the Alaska utilities that have been in the conversation with the legislature and in the public to be able to provide for long-term needs for the project. And then the second one was what we're calling an industrial customer, and in this case, it is the Nutrien plant, which is the ammonia urea plant that's located in Nikiskie, that has been sitting in a mothball status since 2008 when they were cut off from gas from Cook Inlet. So Nutrien, again, will want to contract for enough gas to be able to start two of their units for ammonia production to be able to meet what they see are the demand needs in Asia for not only alternative ammonia uses, alternative fuels, but also fertilizer. And then the pipeline.
Okay, so I think I'm maybe getting more confused. So the third bullet down, contracts with one or more producers at prices low enough to support the economics. That seems to say that you only need a gas sale agreement with one producer at Prudhoe Bay.
Mr. Chairman, it could be one. Yes, we're saying one producer because the volumes we're talking about are significantly less for in-state needs.
Okay. I wanted to make that clear for our committee and the public. So if we just do phase one to serve in-state uses only, you only need a gas supply sale agreement with one of the three partners at Prudhoe or one of the two partners at Point Thompson.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Because okay. the volumes that we're talking about in round numbers, 300 million standard cubic feet a day.
Yeah.
That may be high, as opposed to the 3.3 billion standard cubic feet a day of the full Alaska LNG project.
I didn't, be perfectly honest, I didn't know if that was possible or not with the three ownership or the dual ownership at Point Thompson.
Chair, for the record, Nick Shimoniak, we're exploring options with the producers. It's our understanding that there is a trigger within their unit agreement of a major gas sale at a certain volume, and below that, they can sell disproportionately. But again, we're still investigating. As Mr. Richard says, we are supply agnostic. We're open to buying from all the producers ratably. But at this point, we because of the low volumes, it gives us the ability to shop for the best price, you might say.
Yeah, I think we'd all like to have all of them on board, you know, at the end here. Okay, please continue, and I want to make sure we don't forget about Representative Muir's question.
At the forefront, Mr. Chairman, this is the pipeline route. Again, it's from the North Slope down through the state of Alaska to a termination point for this initial phase. And again, this very first phase of the entire project into the Beluga pipeline system that's owned by NSTAR on the west side of Cook Inlet. So it does not include the Cook Inlet crossing and does not include the compressor stations that you would need for the entire LNG project.
Okay, and just to emphasize, for the benefit of the public, we're talking about a offtake line to Fairbanks. I guess you call it the Fairbanks Lateral. So after all these years and decades of dreaming and hoping, we could deliver low-cost natural gas to Fairbanks.
Mr. Chairman, that was the prime directive when the legislature created us.
I just felt like I have to say that for my colleagues from Fairbanks. Representative Dibert, are you okay with that?
Yes.
Okay. Just, I got to get points when I can get them, you know? Okay, thanks. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. One question is, I understand we're talking about phase one, but as the project rolls out and goes further, what is the potential for off points specifically, such as one that might spur along going to the Ambler Mining District along the potential Ambler Road?
Through the chair, Representative Baker, one of the things that was a great frustration when before we became owner of the project was that there was going to be 3 to 5 limited offtake locations. But from our perspective, this gas line is to provide gas for Alaskans and Alaska resource development and to maximize the benefit for Alaskans. So we've designed an offtake that can occur where there is an economic opportunity to be able that wants the source of gas. So we feel that if there is a community, if there is a mining or any other resource development that would like to have natural gas offtake, then we'll have the ability to have that interconnection point built in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Baker. Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alaska is a big state, and that's a tiny little map on there. What do things look like once we get down to South Central here? And this picture, too, is also a little washed out. Is there, like, new ground being forged there? Are there existing roads or anything that is that last little bit?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, the pipeline itself, I mean, from Prudhoe Bay south to Livengood, follows the Dalton Highway and TAPS corridor. Then from Livengood, it heads south across the Minto Flats. So that's new territory. So the route is, again, not within the area of the Minto Flats, but it's up on the ridge. So it's not down into the critical habitat there. Once it crosses the Minto Flats, it then parallels the Parks Highway and the railroad. So from essentially, we'll call it Nanana south, all the way down to Trapper Creek, it's following existing infrastructure. And so the execution plan calls for the Alaska Railroad to be able to deliver pipe from Port Whittier, Anchorage Port, or even Point McKenzie if there's a rail spur there. to be able to utilize that infrastructure to be able to help execute the project. From Trapper Creek, it then heads south down almost paralleling the Susitna River before it then goes to near to Tyonek, where we intertie with the Beluga pipeline system. So that portion, there is an existing road, rough cut road that's there. There's existing roads in and around Tyonek, but it will be new right away that will be used for the pipeline.
Follow-up, Representative Mears.
Thank you. Quick follow-up, hopefully. Once it gets into the Beluga system, are there any upgrades of that needs to be done, or does any pipeline sizes need to be expanded, or any of the infrastructure upgraded?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, our approach has been to meet the NSTAR specifications for input of gas into their system. So there's a pressure requirement, there's a CO2 requirement, I don't believe there's a heating requirement. So it was designed to be able to meet the NSTAR existing facilities without any improvements.
Okay, please continue.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, part of the discussions that we've had of late is around what would it take if we went in to change the diameter of the pipeline. So what this Boston Square chart represents is on the bottom axis is when we feel that there could be first gas delivered through a pipeline. And then on the vertical axis, or the regulatory risk axis, it's an indication of low regulatory, medium, or high regulatory risk for a project. So in the catbird seat in the lower left-hand corner is the Alaska LNG project. And in this discussion, phase one of the Alaska LNG project, because we have the permits, we are not changing the design, we're meeting the purpose and need of the original environmental impact statement, and we're staying with the 42-inch pipeline. So is it overbuilt for the in-state needs? Yes. However, it's the first phase of the project. So ultimately, with the build-out of the Arctic capture and the liquefaction facility, we'll be able to export. When you look at other projects similar to what we had designed and permitted, the ASAP project, for instance, was a 36-inch diameter. And I'm sorry for the small print here, but that's 36-inch diameter versus the 42 that you see in the lower two diameters. ASAP would need to be re-permitted because those permits were granted back in 2015. So there's been considerable time. Those permits were not kept compliant and current, so therefore we'd have to go back through the regulatory process to be able to change to a 36-inch. And then in the upper right-hand corner, if you were to look at something even smaller, whether it be a 12-inch line, 14, an 18, 24-inch line to run from North Slope down to Interior Alaska, that's a new project, and you'd have to open up a new regulatory process. So that pushes the timeline farther out to the right. So I just wanted to give an overview. From our perspective, these are the regulatory risk versus time Boston Square chart. And this comes after having gone through two, now three, environmental and supplemental environmental impact statement processes.
You know, it just seems to me counterintuitive and wrong that if you downsize a project, you got to start all over again. I mean, it just makes no sense. I better be quiet. I'll let you think.
Mr. Chairman,
if you were making it bigger, I could understand. You know,
sometimes when you try, as an engineer, sometimes when you try and bring logic into either politics or regulatory aspects, it doesn't always work.
Stop me before I get too logical.
Okay.
We better keep going.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So to Representative Muir's question, here's what we are looking at in terms of cost and schedule for the phase one of this project. So running from North Slope to South Central, we estimate it now for the pipeline portion to be $10.7 billion. And this is based on the 42-inch pipeline that will be built without the compressor stations and without the Cook Inlet crossing. And this is based on our updated Class 4 cost estimate, where we've continued to keep the engineering and design work and the field work up to date as best we can. And so we've utilized not only those attributes, but also looked at the impacts of the cost of inflation, as well as the cost of delivery through the supply chains. So we feel that we've got a good class four number here at $10.7 billion. The front-end engineering that I talked about earlier needs to be complete for those reasons, to be able to bring it up to date in regards to, you know, orders, metallurgy, but also to execute on the and develop those construction contracts and specifications necessary to bid this work. This level of FEED, or front-end engineering design, we estimate to cost up to $50 million and will take about 12 months. We're using this number based on conversations with the pipeline company and with EPCs as to what it would take in order to accomplish this. The target date for, as I said earlier, would be to start construction in 2025 with first gas to South Central and Interior by 2029. So to Representative Mears, the $50 million is, again, we would hope to have acquired that $50 million by July 1 of this year. So we are in conversations with folks on to accumulate, I'll say it, through our discussions with investors on that $50 million.
Okay, Mr. Richards, I have to pause just for a moment. I've been staring at him for like 15 minutes, and I forgot to recognize that Representative Sumner has joined us. I have several questions on this slide, but Representative Mears, are you? Did you get your question answered?
Well, I guess a quick follow-up on that is, any through the chair, is any of that $50 million are you asking from us, from our budget process here in the state?
Oh, sorry for that. Through the chair, Representative Mears, the legislature last year was appropriated $2.5 million to AGDC for front-end engineering and design as a portion of a match for the federal $4 million appropriation that Senator Murkowski included in the fiscal year 23 operating budget. So that came as late-breaking news. The Department of Energy, who administers that $4 million grant, wanted to have 100% match. So the legislature appropriated the $2.5 million that we're holding in abeyance until we receive the $4 million from the federal government, and then the $1.5 million remainder will come from our operating budget. So they'll allow for our operating budget expenses to be used as portion of that match. The reason why we haven't received the $4 million from the federal government is because we were very concerned when we learned that there was guidance within the Department of Energy that any grant to a project developer that was seeking federal loan guarantees would be prohibited from those loan guarantees if they had received a federal grant. So we have gone back and forth with the Department of Energy and now got their general counsel opinion that's not the case with this. Because we're phasing the project, by taking the $4 million appropriation, we will not be putting the $31 billion of loan guarantees in jeopardy. And that was really our biggest concern. We didn't want to put in place something that would negatively impact the economics of the project, because those $31 billion represents a significant backstop by the federal government.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, and for whoever, I don't know who is best to answer this, but typically a class four estimate is a polite term for wild wag. How come we don't have a class two estimate? Or am I misconstruing those? Why we've been messing with this for quite a while? Why don't we have a better estimate? Is it just the quickly inflating costs of materials, or
through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe? When we define cost estimates in classes, this really comes from the American Association of Cost Estimators. So they define class six as really a concept level estimate. Class 5 is maybe a feasibility level estimate. Class 4 is a pre-FEED level of estimate. So the reason I say pre-FEED plus, 4 plus or class 4 plus is At the outset of the work that was done by Conoco, Exxon, BP, and AGDC, at the end of pre-FEED, after spending approximately $400+ million, we had a class 4 estimate. So what we've done in that interim is continue on with some of the engineering for that, utilizing the work that we have done for the ASAP project, and then we call it a class 4 plus is because it's not quite to a class 3 yet because we haven't completed that FEED level of effort for this specific pipeline diameter. So class 4 plus is not meant to be negative. It's more meant to say it is in that realm of we've done a level of engineering, a pre-FEED level of engineering, plus a little bit more, and we haven't quite completed the FEED level of engineering. So it's reasonable. Some people will actually go to the market on a class 4 estimate and be able to sign contracts. So we're marching towards that class 3 estimate that will be an outcome of the FEED level of effort.
Thanks. And one just tiny follow-up.
Follow-up, Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. So probably 20-ish years ago, maybe less than that, a little bit less than that, I had a conversation, I think, with somebody in Governor Palin's cabinet about the size of pipeline that would be needed and the thickness based on the pressures. And at that time, there was nobody on the planet that could actually make that pipe. I think that at the time there was maybe 7 steel plants in the world. They were all in South Korea. So I'm wondering if we have actually overcome that. That was a thing. How thick, 42-inch diameter, how thick does it have to be? And can they actually form that into pipe?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe. The 42-inch pipe is a very large pipe. It has been and fabricated in plants around the world. At the time of Governor Palin's administration, though, there were not North American pipe manufacturers capable of rolling that 42-inch pipe. So that pipe was coming from either Germany, Austria, or Japan, and potentially even China at the time. And then India got into the mix. What we've seen, though, over the last decade, though, is that there are now North American pipeline companies that can roll 42-inch. And the pipe thicknesses that we're talking about for this project will range from probably 0.6 inch to 1.25 inch, where we have to bring it above ground at earthquake crossings. But I'll point to the pictures on the wall. That was a 48-inch oil pipeline in its day, and that came from Japanese mills. And so there are mills out there that are capable of doing it. Our preference is North American mills. And that's where we tried to build in and update the cost estimates because we won't have to then look at those import tariffs that are in place on foreign produced pipe.
Thank you. Just think if we had a rail spur that went all the way into Canada from the U.S. and hooked into Canadian railroads, just saying. Thanks.
Okay. Couple more things on this slide. I think it would benefit the public and our committee to understand. So we parallel taps from Prudhoe to Livengood. How many gas compressor stations would we need in that stretch, and could they be placed in the same locations as the taps pump stations? Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And I could look up on the wall. We've got, what is there, 18 pump stations on taps?
There were, I believe, 12 permitted pump stations.
Okay.
So to your point, Chair McKay, there's a little entity called the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, which is the federal organization that is provides for safety oversight of oil and gas pipelines. And they do not want oil and gas pipelines co-located together for the explosion risk and the potential disruption to the environment.
Okay.
So there's been in our design efforts followed those PHMSA regulations so that there is a separation between the TRIPS pipeline and the buried natural gas pipeline. So we've overcome that. Putting the compressor stations in the same location as the pump stations, again, I think there would be a challenge to be able to co-locate them just based on the safety, but I'm not sure.
What's the, I mean, like 100 yards or 5 miles? Or I mean, because those pads are built, the access roads, seems like it would be make things simpler if we could, you know.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to be able to reuse, you know, existing facilities and reduce costs as much as anyone. It's the whether or not we would have to go open up the regulatory process to essentially look to a design change for the location of those, okay. And specifically around the safety components.
Well, I guess my question, I'll restate my question. What is the safe distance that's in our existing permits?
For the pipeline, I can say that it's 500 feet.
Oh, okay. See, I was trying to get a number. Okay. 500 feet.
500 feet. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I thought you were talking specifically about the compressors and the pump stations.
That's okay. All right. Very good. We better keep moving. Maybe we'll come back to this, though. There's a lot of questions about the cost.
Okay. So, again, we went over the slide of the timeline. And, again, this is our understanding is from the utilities, their contracts are falling off, and so they're looking for the near-term availability of gas to meet their needs. Now, in regards to the economics, I'm going to ask Mr. Simoniak to walk through this slide.
Great. For the record, Nick Simoniak, the target for the Phase 1 economics was to ensure that we could deliver gas to South Central utilities at a lower price than the expected price of imported LNG. There are a number of factors that go into that, including the volume of gas that's committed to move through, the cost of gas that's purchased, as well as how we shape the tolls through the pipeline company, essentially sculpt the rate of return over time. And we're working actively with utilities, with Nutrien, with gas suppliers, as well as the pipeline company to determine kind of the final ideal set for these inputs into the economic model. So right now we have kind of a base case where it looks to be about $12, which is much below what we expect imported LNG to be. And if we kind of test different scenarios, you know, some of them start moving it up towards the 12 or 13, 14, 15. But again, we are not quite at the point yet where we have a set number. Again, we're working with the counterparts to figure out who can commit to what and how to best do it. But under most scenarios we've tested, most realistic outcomes, we do believe the cost of gas from this pipeline will be lower than imported LNG. One of the big factors is the more gas you can move through this pipeline paying a toll, the less the cost of the utilities will be. So that involves the utilities buying as much gas as possible under long-term contracts as they can, as well as sales to Nutrien. And Nutrien is, as Frank mentioned, shut down maybe 15, 20 years ago due to lack of gas and high prices. They will not be able to sustain and produce ammonia at the $12 to $15 that the utilities have to pay. But they can pay a significant amount for the gas, and all that revenue from Nutrien will go to directly reduce costs for in-state customers. So we expect a lower sales price to Nutrien than initially we have for the in-state customers. Moving forward, because it's the 42-inch line fully permitted, we expect to aggressively pursue investors in the LNG plant and build out the LNG plant potentially in stages. And as that LNG plant comes online, for preference, it's about 300, 350 million cubic feet a day in state demand. Those LNG plants will be about three times that, about 3 BCF. So that's 10 times the volume moving through. And that provides that extra volume moving through in the future with LNG exports will reduce the in-state price to, we expect, about $4 or $5. So there's a lot of things we're doing to, you know, bring down initially the cost to in-state customers and then in the future. So again, it's underpinned by the price of gas we can purchase it from the producers, as well as the amount of gas we can sell, as well as being offset by those revenues from the industrial customer.
Okay, any questions on that slide? Okay,
to proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Had to think a minute. Go ahead.
All right. So as Nick just described, working with utilities, again, ultimately committing to long-term contracts is going to make this a viable option to be able to move forward. And that utilities support is needed now, but what it really means is that they're willing to engage and talk with the pipeline company about what the cost will be to move the gas down that, as well as working with the producers to be able to make sure that they have a reasonable price of gas that they will commit to. So I make that point is in that we ultimately need to conduct the feed first, while at the same time we can go into contractual negotiations, legal discussions on the full commitments to the project. So I understand that the utilities may be looking at what it's going to take to do feed for an LNG import, and that can be done in parallel. They're not mutually exclusive, is my point, but to be able to meet the needs for Alaskans, we feel that they can be done in parallel. The major pipeline company that I've talked about, again, is very, very, very supportive of phase one, as well as contribution into the Alaska LNG project. And they will take the lead for not only the feed, but all ultimately construction management and ultimately operations of this project with the overall goal of the full Alaska LNG project, because that's where they see the large volumes flowing down the pipe and their interest potentially in LNG participation as well. And then, as Nick described, Nutrien, again, with that old plant that they would retrofit to restart to be able to provide for a new economic engine, I'll call it, within the central Kenai Peninsula, would be it's the industrial base that we need to be able to push the gas volume costs across more than just the utility customers in South Central and Interior Alaska. So Nutrien is looking at what it's going to take right now to conduct that, including the permit renewals and including their plant engineering as well as their financial modeling. And then ultimately, the cost of that gas from the North Slope will hopefully be at a price that makes this economically viable and ultimately to unlock the future LNG exports. Any questions?
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Mr. Richards. So we've heard for years that AGDC is working, quote unquote, with the utilities. Do we have signed agreements, and can you tell the terms, volume, price, firm, interruptible conditions? And also, I'm curious, it says major pipeline. Can you reveal the name of that major pipeline company? Or
through the chair, in regards to the major pipeline company, it asks at this point, based on their own discussions internally, that we not name the pipeline company. But I will just say that they are a very large North American pipeline company. And then in regards to the utilities, the one agreement that we've signed is one with a utility that we offered up that when the full Alaska LNG project is developed, that they will be receiving the gas offtake from the project at a cost no more than the LNG plant will be paying for the gas. So if you remember the cost stack, that would be the cost of gas on the North Slope, the feed gas for the compressors, and the pipeline tariff, as well as the ACC. So that set a ceiling on what that utility has agreed to and what they would receive from the full Alaska LNG project when it's operational. Now, at this point, we are now just in discussions with the utilities and the pipeline company, as well as with the suppliers, on the viability of this and doing red flag analysis. And internally, those companies are doing their own due diligence to make sure that they see this as a viable opportunity and one that they would want to proceed with.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to lay this out there. Do you, with regard to NSTAR, I understand that their parent company is in a position to provide LNG from Canada. So do you believe when you are talking to NSTAR that that they're being straight up with you? I don't know how else to say it. Because they'd probably rather get the LNG from Canada because that benefits their parent company.
Mr. Chairman, I will point to the conversations that we are having with NSTAR. I take them truly at face value that they are being representative of their interest in a pipeline with a source of gas from the North Slope, okay, and that they see that as the long-term best alternative to meet the needs of their customers. And they stated so publicly as well as privately. So
okay.
I believe NSTAR.
Okay. Very well. Good to hear. Okay, next slide. Is there any other questions? Let's go one more slide, and then we'll probably have some more questions.
So the next slide, this is just to reiterate the key benefits off this phased approach is, again, providing long-term energy security for Alaskans from interior Alaska to South Central. It's utilizing the North Slope natural gas that we know is there, and it would reduce potentially the price volatility that Alaskans would see from importing LNG. The economic uplift from this would be the restart of the Nutrien plant. As a previous employer and manufacturer in Alaska, this is value-added product that could then come from Alaska to meet the Asian market needs. And then for the folks in Fairbanks, being able to have pipe gas rather than truck gas will hopefully provide them with a lower cost of energy and address their air quality issues in the long term. And then, as I said, when the full build-out of Alaska LNG occurs with the infrastructure that is developed during this initial phase project, it will allow for the in-state gas delivered cost to customers to come down to that $4 range. So as we started off, Mr. Chairman, you talked about an $8.60 gas price. We're looking at $4, so nearly 50% less.
Hey, Representative McCabe, question?
Thanks. So I'm interested in the restart of the Nutrien plant. Is that based on something new, or is that based on the 2018 evaluation announcement for restart? Are they actually working on restarting the plant? I think on the previous slide you said, one of the previous slides talked about working on the Nutrien plant. Is that current or is that from 2018?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, our discussions with Nutrien is current in that they are looking at the plant. They have done a significant amount of work from 2018 on in terms of what the engineering would look like. They are looking at their existing reformers. They're called steam reformers. They're looking at what it would need to move to the new technology, which are called autothermal reformers and carbon capture. So from their perspective, they see the value in this because they see the market opportunity out there. But they're looking at this, and they've always have indicated they need lower cost gas to be able to accomplish that, to be economically viable. They are now looking for carbon capture from their production as well. And they see that with the opportunity that we have in Cook Inlet, the positive attributes that the state is providing in terms of the bills that are in front of you, that would be positive from their company's criteria for investment.
Perfect. Thanks.
So I have a couple more questions, Mr. Richards, that I'd like to get on the record. I think it's important for the public to know and our committee to know that if my understanding is because of the federal loan guarantees and the possibility of federal grants to help pay for the project, we must use union labor and we must pay Davis-Bacon wages. Is that a correct statement? I just want to make sure I do.
Through the chair, in 2017, I believe, the state of Alaska and AGDC signed on with the union, the local unions in Alaska, about the opportunity to be able to help and advance this project. And that talked about the ability to sign project labor agreements for this project. In talking to major pipeline constructors, most of the North American pipeline contractors use project labor agreements on their projects. So we don't see this as being anything different. I'm not sure that the requirement of the loan guarantees based on a project labor agreement, but we can certainly look at that and get back to the committee.
Seems like that would have a big impact on your cost estimate.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the cost of labor, the cost of skilled labor is going to be high wherever you go in the United States, in Canada, even around the world. So we know that we're going to be paying very high wages to the skilled workers that are going to be needed to build this this project.
So this may be a little bit out of left field, but if the state of Alaska, Alaska citizens, the legislature, bonding, however the vehicle appears or manifests itself to help pay for this $11.7 billion, was that the number earlier?
$10.7 billion.
What would it take? 10%, 20%? Do you have any idea if the state of Alaska or private citizens through bonding chose to participate? Would that help get this thing going?
In all of our conversations to advance the Alaska LNG project, in total and in the phased approach, is that we are identifying that we're reserving the right for up to 25% ownership by, and I'll use air quotes, the state of Alaska. So it could be the state itself, it could be citizens, it could be municipalities, it could be boroughs, it could be Alaska corporations. So we're reserving that right, and what we're doing in our capital raise is offering up 75% ownership to those investors that want to come in, take on the leadership, bring their money to the table to advance us to final investment decision. And then at final investment decision, when you know that you've got an economic project, that you've got your long lead items, that you've got your contracts in place, that's when the state of Alaska can elect to make an offering through any means to be able to accomplish that. And then just for the committee as well as the public online, in the uncodified law section of Senate Bill 138 in 2014, there's actually language that addresses that the Department of Revenue look for opportunities for Alaskans to be able to participate in this project. So that's something that Department of Revenue is aware of and ultimately will be working on.
So just to use round numbers, 25% of $10.7 billion sounds like about $3 billion.
$3 billion.
Somewhere around $3 billion. Okay. Just want to make sure we mention that. Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably going back a little bit, I'm looking at the map of Alaska, and I'm seeing Fairbanks is a little more than halfway down here on a four-year construction timeline for the pipeline. Would they be able to start utilizing gas sooner than South Central?
Through the chair, the lateral building into Fairbanks is only 36 miles, so conceivably, yes, you could execute your construction schedule to be able to move that forward. We haven't sequenced it with either interconnection points or even laterals at this point. It's more just the to meet the overall project need.
I'd want Fairbanks to pay the full tab, though, so because they would probably say, it's good enough. We're not paying any more pests. Representative Mears, follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, what we've got going on right now is a lot of us are driven, you know, very much by our own geographies, and Cooking Like Gas and South Central Energy needs are, you know, in the forefront of a large number of people, because that's where a large number of people reside. But Fairbanks energy prices right now are, you know, quite a bit higher than here. So looking at opportunities for other places is something that we should keep in mind as well.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, I completely agree. And that was the charge that the legislature gave to us, was to make sure that we have the opportunity to be able to deliver gas into interior Alaska, namely Fairbanks, North Star Borough.
Okay, we only have 20 minutes left, so I'm afraid I'm going to ask you to just kind of hurry along, Mr. Richards, and maybe we'll try to ask our final questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I thought I would provide an update on, again, in this case, the full Alaska LNG project. And in this case, we're talking about the investment strategy where we have been engaging with potential developers as well as investors to come and agree to join us to fund the front-end engineering and design. And for this concept, what I'm talking about is the $150 million capital raise that we've talked about. And then ultimately to move us through to final investment decision, or FID. Now, this is an ongoing effort, and we continue to have interest from investors in participating in the full Alaska LNG project and even in the phase one project. But our primary challenge has been combining the capital and the capability of all entities to be able to do this. And what I mean, yes, there's private equity that from private equity firms that don't necessarily have the construction management expertise, but they've invested in other LNG projects. Or it may be that we need an LNG developer who has the capability because they just built a plant or are looking to expand into more plants. Or it could be that we need a lead investor to be able to come in and bring more than half of the capital raised, and they would be the true majority owner that would help drive the project forward. So we have been in conversations with a lot of different folks with a lot of different size and capabilities. What I mean by this is the amount of money that they could bring to the table, whether it be $10 million or $150 million, and anywhere in between, to be able to come and work with us. And to that effort, we've been engaging with Goldman Sachs as our financial advisor, who is working with those investors to verify that they have the funding that they say they do to be able to participate in the project. So Goldman Sachs meets with them. They talk to them about their capability. They see that there's line of sight to that those funds that folks are saying that they have available to bring to the project. And Goldman Sachs is working not directly or not under contract with HDC, but they're working as a financial advisor because they see the ultimate prize will be the debt financing when this project goes to FID. And that's where they will receive their fees. Any questions?
No, please continue.
So as has been reported in the press at the end of the year, that there were potential investors that were working with us primarily as lead investors on the Alaska LNG project. And I cannot provide their names just based on the confidentiality agreements that we have in place with them, but in one case, one of the lead investors decided to pass on the project. They saw the challenge in terms of getting a locked-in gas sale precedent agreement as well as enticing an LNG developer to the project. And so after spending thousands of labor hours and literally millions of dollars on consultants to look at the project, they ultimately decided to pass. The second one was one that is an investor that has ongoing LNG projects that are currently in being challenged with the Biden administration rulings. And so they are not looking to pass on the project, but they wanted to pause at this juncture. Why? Because they currently have a bullseye on their back and they didn't want to necessarily add more by jumping into Alaska as well. So they're on the sidelines watching what we're doing, continuing to engage with them. But until they come forward and commit to the funding, then they're just an interested party watching what we're doing. When we talk about pre-building of the pipeline, this, again, will greatly benefit the overall project because the pipeline has always been viewed by outside investors as a major risk in terms of the construction. Alaska is a faraway land and not the resources available, whatever it may be. And so we're trying to assuage their fears, and by building that piece of infrastructure, that would put those arguments to bed. Now, the construction of the LNG plant, again, the overall plant itself needs to have an entity, what we call the LNG lead party, to be able to come in and work with us, someone who has that capability of designing it, constructing it, and ultimately operating it is ultimately what we need and what the investors want to have the surety that they have a key partner that will take this project through to FID. Now, phase one of the project will allow for gas to flow down to South Central and Interior Alaska, but ultimately it could flow into either in a phased LNG project where you build the first train, you start producing, selling, and then you build the second train, and then you build the third train. So it allows and it opens up the opportunity to move forward with this investment. Now, on LNG sales, what we have not done is actually sign LNG sales agreements. And the reason for this is that we didn't want to commit to a price prior to having the ultimately the feed level of effort nearing FID to make sure that we were putting forward the best project. But when we look at what the U.S. Gulf Coast LNG developers have done, they went out initially and did sign some of the sales purchases agreement, which showed then to their investors that there truly was market interest in the project. And that's where we have been engaged with LNG buyers over the last couple of years and continue to have the conversation. Here they want, in excess of the capacity of the LNG plant. But now may be the time that we look to sign some of those binding agreements that would then provide the surety to the investors that the market interest is truly there. So that's an opportunity that we're undertaking right now. And then, as I described before, North Slope Gas sales agreements are a critical path for both the full project and the phase project. We are in discussions with gas sale agreements with the producers. But again, as I described earlier, the conundrum is that producers want to see that there's a creditworthy purchaser of that gas downstream, and those downstream gas purchasers want to see the price. And we find ourselves now in this conundrum with no price.
You go first.
Correct. And then federal support. I believe that Senator Sullivan was here last week, and I will tell you that he is tirelessly working to advance and help this project. He spoke to it in his speech, but again, he is out there flying to the countries of Japan and Korea, interfacing with the presidents of those countries, as well as their cabinet members, as well as off-takers in those countries. So he is a tireless advocate, and we greatly appreciate that. The loan guarantees that Senator Murkowski got put into the Infrastructure Reduction Act gave the opportunity for Alaska LNG to then be eligible for these federal loan guarantees to the tune of $31 billion. That means that the full faith and credit of the United States would then back the debt financing on this project. That will help reduce the overall debt financing. So that's a major positive. In the Biden administration, Ambassador Rahm Emanuel and the ambassador to Japan has also been an extremely tireless advocate for Alaska LNG to be able to meet the needs of the Japanese. He sees the strategic value of a Pacific Coast project meeting the needs of our Asian allies to supply the energy sources and cut off the Russian gas. And then the Department of Energy last year, concluding their supplemental environmental impact statement, concluding that we are net positive in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions, and ultimately affirming the environmental process that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission undertook, but also affirming the free trade and non-free trade authorizations that the project has to sell to the market. And then Senator Murkowski's fiscal year 23 appropriation last year, the tax credits that we talked about earlier, and then the current and ongoing engagement that we have not only with the congressional members, but their staffs that are working within the administration, but also with other members of Congress to overcome challenges that are presented to Alaska LNG. And then the Department of Revenue conducted an economic model last year looking to see what the revenue would be to the state of Alaska from the Alaska LNG project. So again, this is the full project, 20 million ton, $44 billion project. It's based on a dollar gas price on the slope, so just a marker that was placed out there. And it identifies that it does include the full property tax. But not doesn't show the share going to the borough. So again, the 20 mil rate that's currently in statute, state gets a portion, the boroughs get a portion. And then again, it's based on that there are no liquid losses. And by this, I mean that there's not lost oil kept in the ground by producing the gas. So as you can see, it doesn't generate billions of dollars at the outset to the state of Alaska, but it does generate hundreds of millions of dollars that would be flowing into the treasury. And then after the debt financing is complete, then we're talking north of $1 billion. So it would be a benefit to the state of Alaska to commercialize those resources through the sale of LNG.
So real quickly, Mr. Richards, just for the benefit of the committee and the public, obviously continuing to cycle gas at Prudhoe and Point Thompson produces more oil, which is quite a bit more valuable than gas. So the longer we can do that, the better for our state treasury. So if you had a, I don't know, a 10-year gap between the in-state line and then the full LNG project, that's 10 years more of oil production that you're able to benefit from. Is that a reasonable amount of time in your crystal ball of how you might see this? You know, if we build the in-state line and then I'm just picking it out of the air 10 years later, LNG plant and export. That's it. Too long, too short? Don't know.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's multifaceted question in that if you recall, in 2014, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission authorized from Prudhoe Bay unit alone 3.6 billion standard cubic feet a day for a major gas sales. So at that time, AOGCC thought that they, out of the 8 billion that's currently being produced and recycled out of Prudhoe Bay alone, there could be a reduction of 3.6 without significantly impacting
oil recovery.
Now, my understanding is, again, of the operations on the North Slope, gas handling capacity has become a challenge. As more gas has come up with the smaller volumes of oil, therefore the oil production is peaked or limited by the gas handling. So if you offtake some of that gas, then you have the potential to actually increase, as you're suggesting, more oil production.
Okay.
What the time frame will, where that sweet spot is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do understand that the producers are updating and reviewing their full field model to be able to look at the impacts of gas sales into the project.
Okay.
You want to add?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you might allow me to add one more thing for the record, Nick Shimoniak. The other thing to take into account is the longer we delay the LNG exports, the longer us Alaskans are paying $12 to $15 per million BTU. The quicker we can start exporting LNG from this project, the quicker we get the prices down to $4 to $5. So as the current pipeline developer, that's a major motivator for AGDC.
So I hate to get into hypotheticals too much, and I know we don't have much time left, but if we get the worst case scenario, you know, we get into a situation where we build a 42-inch pipeline, we put in the compressor stations, we put in the carbon capture plant, we're feeding gas all the way across the state, and then the LNG portion never happens. I don't want to be a skunk at the garden party, so to speak, but that is something to think about, right? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. There are risks associated with building an oversized pipeline. And that's why, when we looked to see what the need was for South Central and Interior Alaska, that was one of the prime motivators. So, but the 42-inch, again, gives you that ability to export should you want to. And at this, in the initial phase, again, we're not building that carbon capture plant nor the compressor station. So those costs are not incurred in this. And the economic modeling that Nick has described earlier is based on the flow of gas into the industrial user as well as the utilities and keeps it at that $12 to $14 until there is more volume flowing through the pipe, whether it be from an ammonia plant, whether it be from an LNG first train, two trains, or three trains. And that additional volume flowing through the pipe lowers then the cost of gas to Alaskans because you're spreading the cost over more molecules.
Okay. Representative Mears, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, through the chair, I just want to clarify, and that just piqued my brain right now. So what we're talking about is in-state delivery only from this pipeline project would be relatively on par, although slightly less than what we're looking at for potentially imported LNG.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, that's our target. Yes, it has to meet or beat that price.
But it's in the same ballpark.
Correct.
Okay, a couple more slides, please continue.
All right. We all know major project, it will require a lot of workers, Alaskan workers, to be able to complete this. Peak construction of 12,000, 1,000 operational jobs. So new economic viability around this project that beyond just the revenue generation into the state of Alaska and energy for our homes. And then lastly, we've talked about hydrogen as an opportunity. And this is the conversion of methane into hydrogen for as a fuel source. And the ammonia plant that Nutrien has is an old plant, but then again, under the steam reformers, they're looking to capture that carbon. But there are new technologies, the autothermal reformers and carbon capture. There's an opportunity here if there more gas flows down the pipe to be able to have additional industrial demand off this project. And then with that, the carbon capture in Nikiski for those new plants, we have this sequestration right there with the depleted oil and gas fields, the saline aquifers, and the underlying coal seams. So there is the opportunity to future-proof this project with ammonia and with carbon capture to keep this project proceeding. Because as you know, the North Slope has just abundant natural gas resources. So after 30 years of full production, new sources will come online to be able to meet potentially new needs. And that, Mr. Chairman, is our update.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So back on slide 20, I have a question, and I'm curious if you think that you will have a better chance or better luck in attracting investors just for phase one of the project, or if you're going after the whole enchilada.
Through the chair, Representative Vice Chair McCabe, I would say that our current discussions with existing investors are good for both projects. And in particular for the phase one project, that's a major positive because they're willing to put their money forward to advance this project and ultimately bring it to fruition. The ongoing discussion after the Department of Energy's executive order by the Biden administration on the Department of Energy's halting of DOE authorizations has created more interest and more potential for us to work with investors and even new investors or older investors that have passed on the project because they had other alternatives. So right now, I would say it's keen investment interest. And again, it's going to be the challenge of making sure we got a viable gas supply number and an LNG developer. But the piece of infrastructure in between, that pipeline, having that built will be significantly beneficial to that the opportunity of Alaska LNG.
Thanks.
Just one quick follow-up.
So thank you. Through the chair, I'm wondering where you would see the project right now. You know, I asked the question specifically about the Class 4 versus Class 2 because it has to do with the scoping of the project. Class 4 is 1 to 15%. Class 2 is 70% more. So as far as scoping the project, where would you say we are right now?
Through the chair, Vice Chair McCabe, I would say that we are the project is scoped. It is, again, through the permitting effort, we included all the components of the project, the location of the project, the impacts of the environment from those project components. And so that is what we've stayed with so that we don't open ourselves up because we want to change an alignment or add additional features here. That will come potentially under this FEED level of effort and through the execution and work with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission through the implementation plans that they authorize those pieces of construction.
Thanks. I through the chair again, I thought that's where it looked like, but the mixed message of the Class 4 kind of made me question that. So thanks.
Representative Rausch has a question. Mr. Richards.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So, Mr. Richards, I guess I... from some of the emails and some of the comments that I've been getting, so basically they feel that we are where I was in committee 8 years ago, different year, different governor, different investors, different asking amount, same pipeline. Can you dispel what I just said?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, unfortunately, we are in a situation very similar to 10 years ago where Cook Inlet gas production is uncertain. And what that will mean to those of us that consume that gas through electrons or through home heating have to worry about where the future is going to be. So what we have done over those 10 years is advanced not one but two projects, one being an in-state project through front-end engineering design to a cost level of estimate that unfortunately without huge state subsidization would prove to be uneconomic. Where we find ourselves today is with, again, interested parties that must make that internal decision within their own corporations to be able to advance the work and provide the funding to make this project viable. If I could snap my fingers and make them do it, I would. However, I don't have that power. They ultimately need to be able to make this decision themselves, to be able to move their investment dollars into a project. And so it has to meet their economic criteria. It has to meet their investment criteria, and it has to ultimately meet their stockholder criteria. So I would say to Alaskans, yes, it is frustrating that we find ourselves here. I'm frustrated because I had hoped to be able to be under construction by this point, but we're not. However, we know that the resource is there. It can be delivered at a reasonable cost so that producers make money, that Alaskans can get gas at a reasonable cost through a project that we feel is economically viable at the start of this Alaska LNG project, and then that is really a linchpin to the full entire Alaska LNG project. And that's where the major prize is, because it's lower cost gas at that $4 per MMBTU. It's revenues to the state, it's jobs to the state, but it also provides the opportunity for offtake to resource development, because that's one of the biggest things, the challenges in our state. We have the great resources, but it's an issue of transportation and it's an issue of energy. And so by having natural gas as a low-cost energy source will hopefully be a game changer and allow for more economic opportunity in the state of Alaska.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that last sentence was critical to me, Mr. Richards. So we've got to wrap up. I just want to say thank you very much, Nick and Mr. Richards. This project is of intense interest to us, especially given the cold snap that we had in South Central here recently and the situation in Cook Inlet. So we're very, very interested in how you're coming along, and I hope we can have you back soon and, you know, maybe get some more progress and more clarity. So with that, I will thank you again, and our next meeting is Wednesday at 1:00, and we are now adjourned at 3:03 p.m.